From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Karen Armstrong is a scholar of the world's religions and author of the bestseller, A History of God. Before she became a scholar, she was a nun, but she left the convent after 7 years, feeling she'd failed to find God. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Armstrong about her memoir, The Spiral Staircase, a reflection on leaving the convent and returning to the secular world. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings of Shostakovich's 4th, 5th, 7th, and 9th symphonies conducted by Valeri Gergiev. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Woody Allen film, Melinda and Melinda. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Karen Armstrong has become famous for her books about the religions of the world. She's written about fundamentalism, Islam, and the life of the Buddha. She also wrote the bestseller, A History of God. But before she became a scholar of religion, she was a nun. She entered the convent as an idealistic 17-year-old and left 7 years later in 1969 after suffering a mild breakdown, feeling she'd failed to find God. The world she entered in 1969 couldn't have been more different from her sheltered life in the convent. While she was in the convent, many of her contemporaries had formed hippie communes. While she learned restraint, younger people were trying to free themselves of inhibitions, including sexual ones. Armstrong wrote about her reentry into the secular world in her memoir, The Spiral Staircase. It's a sequel of sorts to her first book, Through the Narrow Gate, a memoir about her life in the convent. The Spiral Staircase has just come out in paperback. Terry Gross spoke with Karen Armstrong last year.
It sounds like you entered the convent to find some form of spiritual transformation and also to avoid the things that made you most uncomfortable as a teenager or a young woman. Let's start with the things that made you uncomfortable as a teenager that you hope maybe to avoid by going into the convent.
Well, I wasn't a very successful teenager in the 1950s. I looked ridiculous in the fashions, the sticking out skirts, the pointed toed shoes, the beehives. I was hopeless with boys, bookish, shy, very shy in those days. I felt I would be socially inept, that I was dreaded the social demands. Also, I looked around at the lives of women in the late 1950s, early 60s, and I saw them all toiling at washing and cooking and cleaning, chores that I detest to this day. And the nuns seemed remarkably unencumbered, and I thought that they were living lives of real meaning, and that they had a sort of radical freedom, as I thought, that I wanted to have too.
Now, the convent was not what you expected. Your community was founded in the 19th century. And you write that customs that made sense when the convent was founded, when the community was founded, now seemed arbitrary and unnatural, practices that had no intrinsic spiritual value but were cultural relics of the Victorian age had acquired sacred significance. What are some of those customs and practices that were very Victorian that you didn't think really made any sense in the 1960s?
Well, we were being asked to become Victorian women. Our eyes were always to be cast down, I was always getting told off for looking people boldly in the eye, but I'd always been taught to look people in the face when you answered them, not sort of cast your head down humbly. Always to laugh in a restrained trill, not to speak too loudly, not to run. But more important was the, I think, the emotional frigidity of our lives. Victorian women were not supposed to have strong feeling. And yet we were supposed to be iron ladies of iron self-control. And so I think our life was very cold. We were not supposed to have friendship. We were never allowed to have conversations in a two. We always had to wait until a third person came along before we could talk. We had to give all our love for God, and that often made us rather cold and forbidding and unkind to one another.
And where did obedience figure into your life in the convent?
Oh, obedience in our order was crucial. We had the rule of St. Ignatius, who had been a soldier before he turned to the religious life, and he'd wanted his Jesuits to be soldiers of God. And we, in our own way, too, had to practice that kind of military obedience. Ours was not to wonder why. Ours was but to do and obey our superior as unflinchingly and immediately as a soldier will obey his commanding officer. The idea was, during our training, that we were supposed to divest of ourselves of our secular, practical, worldly ways of looking at things and embrace God's way. And there was one occasion, for example, when my superior told me that I had to practice at a sewing machine that didn't have a needle. And I sort of sat there treadling this empty machine for a couple of weeks, telling myself that this was the best way in which I could be using my time. And after all, the idea was to make you lose your own will and judgment and rely entirely on the will and judgment of your superior who stood in the place of God for you. And so when we spoke to our superiors, we always knelt down at her feet to remind ourselves that she wasn't just an ordinary boss or a human being. She was God's representative.
Did you feel at war with yourself? Because on the one hand, I'm sure you believed that on some level, obedience could be a discipline that would lead to transcendence, putting yes. something else above the petty desires and needs of your personal ego. But at the same time, you thought some of the things you were being asked to obey were pointless and ridiculous.
Yes. There was constant conflict because, and I really did go in for it. I really did try. But of course, the thing is, too, you've got to realize that we were entirely isolated from the world. So we had no, our superior's whims and desires and orders became our whole universe. We didn't read the newspapers. We knew nothing about what was going on in the world. I entered a few weeks before the Cuba Missile Crisis, when the World War III seemed about to break out. And they did tell us that we were in this danger of imminent nuclear war. But then they forgot to tell us that the crisis was over and that when we had another 3 weeks of scanning the horizon anxiously for mushroom clouds. And until finally one of us had, we weren't ever supposed to ask for news of the world. And finally one of us said, what happened about Cuba? And they said, oh, we forgot to tell you, it's all over. So we were so isolated. When I left the convent in 1969, I'd scarcely heard of the Beatles. And I'd certainly never heard of Vietnam.
When you were in the convent, you started studying at Oxford University, where you were taught to think critically and challenge all assumptions, and then you'd have to go home to the convent where you were taught to be obedient and never challenge. And it's impossible to reconcile those two worlds, isn't it?
Yes, and I was feeling myself continually in that first year at Oxford split apart, because part of me was absolutely reveling and luxuriating in the freedom to read books and read whatever I wanted, knowing this was my job. It was just intoxicating to me. I loved it. And yet, on the other hand, there was this deadly weight of disapproval if you sort of wanted to try out your newly honed critical skills on the nuns at home, because we were supposed still to be obedient. And I wanted to stay. There was no sense that I was yearning to escape. I was terrified of leaving, quite terrified. And to leave seemed, even to think of leaving was like it was like breaching a taboo. It was so monumental and awful a step. But eventually, at the end of that year, I had a breakdown. It was only a mild breakdown, but it became quite clear to all of us, my superiors and myself, that I couldn't continue.
What were the symptoms of the breakdown?
Well, I was constantly crying. I cried throughout my whole religious life like a broken waterspout, I have to say. I just kept bursting into tears. We were told that if we weren't finding life impossibly difficult, we weren't trying hard enough. So they must have been delighted with me, because I never stopped crying. And I'm not a crier, really, these days. But I think it was a great strain. And we were all also convulsed with giggles, too. I mean, one of us would start giggling at something utterly unremarkable, and the whole lot of us, it would go like almost a disease, a contagion. We were on the brink of real strain, I think. In that last year, too, I had had fainting attacks and also terrible nosebleeds and vomiting. And then finally, I just collapsed. I was supposed to be serving in the dining hall, and I just passed out. And I cried and cried and cried and said, kept on saying, I can't do it. I can't do this. And they were wonderfully kind to me. They really were. They sort of saw that something had gone badly wrong, and they wanted to do everything they could to make me feel that I could take my time about deciding exactly what I wanted to do without any pressure. And they put no pressure on me to stay. though, said that they would be very sad to lose me. We were all sad at the end.
Well, some of the problems, the physical problems that you described, the fainting spells, the vomiting, some of this was like symptoms of what was later diagnosed as epilepsy. But at the time,
yes.
No one knew that that's what it was. And so you were diagnosed with hysteria. It was considered to be a nervous reaction to your life.
Yes.
Do you think, had you known that the problem was epilepsy, that you might have stayed in the convent?
No, I wouldn't have stayed, because there was another thing that was eating away at me corrosively throughout my religious life, was that I was unable to pray. And that is obviously a drawback for a nun. I can now concentrate on my work for hours at a time without even noticing the time passing. But as soon as I would go into the convent chapel to begin my meditation every morning, my mind would just go everywhere. And nobody else seemed to have these difficulties. I was waiting to encounter God, and I never did. And the fact that I could not even keep my mind on my prayer for more than 2 minutes at a time meant that my whole, it was a terrible secret shame I hugged to myself, because a nun's commitment is measured and by the quality of her prayer. And I also harboured secret doubts about, you know, was there a God even? Who could tell that Jesus had been God and man at the same time? And a nun who had these kind of doubts could not be going to be a good nun. So there was this, despite the epilepsy was an added problem, it became a monumental problem once I'd left the convent. But I don't think that I would have stayed.
The doctor who did diagnose your epilepsy told you that a lot of people who become religious have this form of epilepsy. It's temporal lobe epilepsy.
Yes.
Have you looked into that to see what the connection is?
Yes. I think epilepsy of the temporal lobe it's the seat, I believe, of the memory and many of the emotions. And so you are living constantly on the brink of things. Dostoevsky suffered from it, and he writes about it in his book called The Idiot. When you're in convulsion, your mind can sort of explode, and it looks as though you're seeing God. And I have experienced that once or twice, but I knew this was only, by that time, the epilepsy had been diagnosed, and I knew this was only a neurological thunderstorm. And the sense of evil and fear and terror I had could easily have been seen as the devil or a demonic presence. So Van Gogh had it, and you see, I think, in some of his landscapes with those tortured, writhing olive trees, or that brilliantly swirling, menacing, starry sky. You see a world that's slightly out of kilter, slightly more intense. Another thing that people with temporal lobe epilepsy tend to do is to write a lot. Think of those big, fat volumes of Dostoevsky and Van Gogh's letters to his brothers, and I suppose my own books a lot of people keep diaries or write poems or obsessively chronicle their experience. But in a pre-scientific age, some of those experiences could easily have been thought to be supernatural.
Karen Armstrong speaking with Terry Gross. She wrote the bestseller A History of God. Her memoir, The Spiral Staircase, about reentering the world after 7 years as a nun, is now out in paperback. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Terry's interview with Karen Armstrong, a scholar of religion who's written several best-selling books, including A History of God and Islam. Her memoir, The Spiral Staircase, is out in paperback. It's about life when she came out of the convent and also about her life inside the convent. She was there from 1962 to 1969.
You came back into the world in 1969 at the height of the counterculture. And, you know, the counterculture was in part about losing inhibitions. It was about sexual freedom. You'd been raised in what you describe as absolute physical restraint. What were some of the most baffling new things going on in the world when you got out of the convent in 1969?
Well, there I was in my Oxford college, surrounded by students who were demonstrating their rage and protest with something called the establishment or the system, and carrying placards and protesting. I mean, I had been schooled in an institution where young people were subservient and almost cravenly subservient. And the idea of voicing your disapproval in the way that these young people were was astonishing to me, because in pre-1960s, we had been... young people were seen and not heard. These young people were confident. They were clearly sexually involved. And in my days, before the contraceptive pill, sexual intercourse was a tremendously dangerous and risky enterprise, not to mention a major mortal sin. And this didn't seem to worry these young people at all. And they all wore these kind of raggedy clothes or skirts right up to their thighs. And it was a sort of carnival. And I had no notion what was going on. I remember going to my first party and hearing a song and trying to show an interest and say, who are these people? And everybody gaped at me and said, well, they're the Beatles, of course. And I'd never knowingly heard one of their records. And I thought they were named after those little insects that crawled around. And I had that, all that had to be explained. So while all this carnival of joyous 60s exuberance was going on, I was looking on bewildered and also sad, because I just felt so appallingly sad about having left the convent and having to relinquish that old dream and feeling a terrible sense of failure.
It's interesting, you know, I've been talking to you for several years now on Fresh Air, and I always think of you as so authoritative and having such a kind of organized life, and reading about your life and the problems that you had and the failures that you had early on with your dissertation, which for very complicated reasons wasn't accepted because of the guy who was who was the judge of it. And, you know, you got fired from a teaching job. Things were just, like, not working out. And it's understandable that at the time you thought that nothing was ever going to work out for you. And then, of all things, you started working on a TV documentary series for Channel 4 in England about religion. And that's where you really learned that scholarship was really, religion scholarship was your calling. And some people might find it really paradoxical that it was through television that you discovered the importance of scholarship in your life, that religion scholarship.
Yes, I mean, I'd never thought. By this time, after a few years of leaving the convent, I gave up religion altogether. I wanted nothing more to do with it. And if I saw people reading a religious book on a train or something, I felt quite sort of ill with horror at the thought of all that awful stuff, as I dismissed it. But then, after a series, as you say, of career disasters, I ended up in television. Found that I did start making these skeptical television programs. My first programs were extremely skeptical, and that was very suitable for London, which is a very secular city. Britain's a very secular country. People look at religion with disdain. And I did a documentary series on St. Paul, and yet, at the same time as I was pointing out the evils of religion and the disorders of religion, which I chronicled almost, it was cathartic for me to get all that off my chest and liberating. But also I found myself, much to my astonishment, being drawn through my study of St. Paul to a much great affection for this pugnacious apostle. And similarly, with the other... I began to see that there had been a lot in my religious background that had been very limited. I encountered for the first time when I was working in Jerusalem on this project on St. Paul, Judaism and Islam, about which I knew nothing. My religious horizons had been wholly Christian. And I began to find that there were in these other Abrahamic traditions things and elements and visions and ideals that I could really relate to. And so slowly, it was by infinitesimal degrees, I began to see that there was more in religion than I'd imagined, and found myself gradually brought back through study, through television initially, into a religious orbit again, and was beginning to look increasingly as the years went by a little more favorably on it.
Karen Armstrong's memoir is called The Spiral Staircase. It's now out in paperback. She spoke with Terry Gross last year. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, featuring the 2005 ESPN Baseball Encyclopedia from Sterling Publishing, a division of Barnes & Noble. From Bantam Paperbacks, publisher of The Game, a novel of suspense featuring Mary Russell and Sherlock Holmes by Laurie R. King. And from the Alzheimer's Association, encouraging Americans to stay active, eat right, and make brain health a personal and national priority at alz.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with religion scholar Karen Armstrong about re-entering the secular world after 7 years in the convent. Also, Lloyd Schwartz reviews new recordings conducted by Russian composer Valery Gergiev, and David Edelstein reviews Melinda and Melinda, the new Woody Allen film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with religion scholar Karen Armstrong. Her books include the bestsellers Islam and A History of God. Before studying religion, Armstrong tried living the religious life. She entered a convent as a teenager in 1962. After 7 years, she decided she wasn't cut out to be a nun. Armstrong's memoir about her time in the convent and her re-entry into the world is now out in paperback. It's called The Spiral Staircase. Terry spoke with Armstrong last year.
Where are you now in terms of being a kind of practitioner or believer? Would you use any words like, you know, faithful, agnostic, atheist, whatever, to describe yourself?
Well, I used to call myself a freelance monotheist because I studied all three of the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, I couldn't see any one of them as superior to any of the others. I draw nourishment from all three. And I'm enthralled, indeed, increasingly by all three at their best. But that's not really I can't really say that anymore, because since then I've written about the Buddha and was absolutely just delighted by his insights, and that affected me profoundly, especially his emphasis on compassion and practice. He was so sensible, the Buddha, but the Buddha was no theist. And in recent years, I've been studying the Hindu tradition and the Chinese traditions, Confucianism and Taoism. So I would see myself perhaps a bit eclectic. Sometimes I call myself a convalescent. I'm still sort of recovering, I think. But increasingly, I see all these faiths at base have so much in common. They are all so profoundly related. And that gives me great heart, because you see that your own tradition into which you were born is not just a lonely, idiosyncratic little quest, but part of a grand human quest for meaning and significance over the centuries.
So if studying religion is a quest for meaning, and if you see religion itself as a quest for meaning, do you find yourself believing in the existence of a God? And if so, what shape does that God have?
No, I don't. I think belief, sorry to sound evasive, but I think belief is a red herring. Quite early on in my studies, I had the good fortune to talk to a Jewish scholar friend of mine, Chaim Maccabee, who's also an author. And he told me the story of Rabbi Hillel, the older contemporary of Jesus. And Hillel was approached by a group of pagans who said that they would convert to Judaism if the rabbi would recite the whole of the Torah while he stood on one leg. And Hillel stood on one leg and said, "Do not do unto others as you would not have done unto you. That's the Torah. The rest is commentary. Go and learn it." And I said to Chaim, "Well, what did he expect these pagans to believe?" And he said, "Oh, easy to see, you were brought up Christian. You know, we don't care so much about belief." But that was a wonderful gift to me, that moment, because I came to see that the golden rule is the essence of religion. If you live in that way, you become putting yourself on the back burner, looking into your own heart, finding what grieves and pains you, and not inflicting that grief and pain on other people. Do not do unto others. If we did this on a daily, hourly basis, we would be constantly transcending ourselves, going beyond ourselves, and getting glimpses of a sacred transcendent reality. And I suppose I'm with the Buddha, with Confucius, and also with Hillel there, who weren't going to give a great discourse on the nature of the divine or the sacred or the Tao or Nirvana. The Buddha always said these are improper questions. He said, behave in a certain way, live in a certain way, above all by compassion, and then you will know that this exists. And I myself, since I've been trying to live like that, and in fact it was my study that helped me to come to this perception, have found a sense of joy and purpose and enlargement of heart, though I'm by no means on some pinnacle. So I get intimations of this. For me, the personal God didn't work.
When you say personal God, do you mean a God you have a personal relationship with, or a God that's embodied in some kind of personhood that we could name that has a shape?
Yes.
The latter?
The latter, but I couldn't have a personal relationship with God, because all these prayers, all my trying to talk to him, and I didn't get it. I didn't do it. Now, that's fine. I'm not in the business of dismantling other people's faith. If the personal God works for you and opens doors, then this is just wonderful, and I applaud it. The test is that it leads you to practical compassion, because that's what all the world religions tell us. I think, and after all, God is what we call God, what we call the divine or the sacred, is indescribable. It is it goes beyond our little theological systems. It is literally transcendent. It is infinite and cannot therefore be defined, a word that means to set limits upon. We can all only have these glimpses, but we can know in our hearts a transcendence that changes us and that makes our life worth living. The Buddhists would say that this transcendence is not supernatural at all. You see, they'd say it was quite natural to humanity to have this sense of wonder and awe and a fulfillment that takes you beyond the limitations of your mundane secular self.
As we record this interview, you have not seen or not yet seen Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ. How much was the suffering of Christ emphasized in the convent?
Quite a bit, quite a bit. And so that's why I wonder about it. We even looked at little movies ourselves. They're rather primitive movies, lantern slide movies of the suffering of Christ. And the message was, I did that. You know, it was my sins that put you on the cross. And even as a young child, we were told this. And we were told prayers. Oh, my Jesus, I am the person who flogged you. I am the... And really, this is a heavy trip for an 8-year-old or even an 18-year-old. You know, you once dismal little peccadilloes did this. This ruined my relationship with Christ. So even to this day, I find it difficult to... think of Jesus without a sort of sinking feeling of dread, guilt, shame, and horror at what I apparently did. So I think that so that's why I wonder about this film.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever ask yourself, like, if you could redesign the convent experience, what that experience might be like?
I think it might be like what I have now, strangely enough. Because I often wryly think to myself that I am still a kind of nun in a way. I live alone. I've never married. I spend my life writing, thinking, speaking about God and religion and spirituality, entirely engrossed in this. And I sometimes think that my early attempt to enter the religious life was an early stab at the kind of existence that I have now, but which wasn't available for me then.
You describe yourself in your book as a failed heterosexual. But it sounds like you live an almost monastic life in terms of that. Is that something that you feel like you've renounced in some way, that you're still almost... Yeah.
No, I'm not. I've never been very popular with men. I have to say, I've got a lot of men friends who love me dearly, and I them. But I think that at the time when when I should have been finding a mate, I was either struggling with my post-convent trauma or suffering from this disease, undiagnosed disease, which distorts your perceptions. Freud said that if you are in pain, if you have toothache, you can't fall in love. And I think that the pain is so overwhelming that kind of relationship is impossible. And I think at the time when I was supposed to be doing all that, when you're biologically geared up to do all that, I was in too much psychic and physical trouble. Also, I wasn't used to men. And when I started working with them, I treated them as though they were ordinary people, in my view, as though they were women, and didn't realize that you had to treat them a bit differently as a woman and not tell them, oh, you can't, that's not a good idea. I remember saying that to one of my directors, you know, I can't have that idea. It's not right. And he said, all right, don't use this idea, and stormed off in a great sulk. So I didn't have that knack. I seem inept at that knack with those winning ways that men of my generation seem to like. I think younger men, it's probably a different matter. Also, men my age tend to be a bit big on control. And I've worked so hard for my freedom that I don't want to have somebody tell me what to do. But then I ask myself to, you know, was I pushed into this solitude, or did I jump? Because I think my solitude is, in a sense, very much part of my work. I don't think I could have written so much or be so involved in my work had I got family obligations. And so I think it might have, my solitude, which I've often regretted, and I've often felt isolated and lonely, but I often think that perhaps, again, it was meant that it had some significance that I'm only just now perhaps beginning to understand.
Well, we're out of time, but I'm just going to ask you, this is a horrible thing to do, for a yes or no answer on this, because we're so out of time, but do you still feel uncomfortable in the world, or do you feel like you belong in the world now?
I do belong in the world, but I'm still a bit of an outsider, not married, writing about religion, living in a country that doesn't approve of religion, and yet I have sort of yet too, my work has brought me not only to the centre of my life, but also to the centre of people's concerns in this religiously troubled age. So, yes, I do belong to the world now, more than I ever thought I would, though I've never entirely fitted in. I'm still a bit of that solitary nun.
Karen Armstrong, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
Religion scholar Karen Armstrong speaking with Terry Gross. Armstrong's memoir about reentering the world after 7 years as a nun is called The Spiral Staircase. It's now out in paperback. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on one of the world's most charismatic conductors. This is Fresh Air. One of today's busiest musicians is the Russian conductor Valery Gergiev. He's the Metropolitan Opera's very first principal guest conductor, the music director of two orchestras, and director of the White Nights Festival in St. Petersburg. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says he's also one of the most charismatic figures on stage.
The first time I sat up and took notice of Valery Gergiev was back in 1995, during the Boston Symphony's retrospective of works honoring the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. Gergiev conducted the most famous symphony to come out of the war, Shostakovich's 7th, the so-called Leningrad Symphony. Shostakovich actually started it before the Nazi siege of the city now called St. Petersburg, but the attack gave him a new focus. I confess, I have mixed feelings about Shostakovich symphonies in general. So often, he seems heavy-handed, bombastic, and sarcastic. He goes on as long as Mahler, but without Mahler's more novelistic variety and melodic inspiration. In the first movement of the 7th Symphony, Shostakovich's little joke is to take the light-hearted "I'm going to Maxime's" number from The Merry Widow and turn it into an aggressive, interminably repetitive march. But by subtly increasing the volume of each repetition and never losing the central rhythmic drive, Instead of making me want to scream with boredom, Gergiev had me at the edge of my seat. Those excerpts were from the Shostakovich Seventh Gergiev recorded just a week after September 11, 2001, leading the combined forces of his two orchestras, the Kirov Orchestra of St. Petersburg-famed Mariinsky Theater and the Rotterdam Philharmonic. Gergiev now feels there's a close connection among the six symphonies, 4 through 9, that Shostakovich composed in the decades surrounding the Second World War, and he's in the process of recording them as a group. His latest is the 4th. Composed in 1935, it's both autobiographical and apocalyptic. So schizophrenic, it threatened Stalin's political agenda for music. The composer suppressed the symphony just before its premiere. As The New Yorker's Alex Ross wrote recently, Shostakovich's urge to defy authority was always tempered by an instinct for survival. The 4th Symphony went unperformed for 22 years. Shostakovich's most popular symphony is his 5th, maybe because of Leonard Bernstein's famous recording with its celebratory ending. We'll probably never know what Shostakovich really intended. What I like about Gergiev's performance is its ambiguity. Is the last movement triumphant or despairing? For Gergiev, music can be both. My personal favorite of Shostakovich's symphonies is the 9th. It was controversial because it seemed too lightweight a response, both to the end of the war and to the tradition of a huge 9th symphony started by Beethoven. Again, Gergiev refuses to simplify its multiple layers of irony. Thank you. our current climate of international anxiety, I don't really want to hear war music. But with his emphasis on ambiguity and his masterful sense of structure and pacing, Gergiev actually makes me want to listen.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. Valeri Gergiev and the Kirov Orchestra will be touring North America beginning March 27th with a stop at Carnegie Hall April 4th through 6th. Coming up, a review of Woody Allen's new film. This is Fresh Air. Woody Allen has a new movie, his 35th feature film. It's called Melinda and Melinda, and it's two versions of the same story rolled into one movie. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
The premise of Woody Allen's Melinda and Melinda is not just great. It's great for Allen. In a prologue, two playwrights in a restaurant, Wallace Shawn and Larry Pine, looking a lot like Andre Gregory, argue about comedy versus drama and which form is the more vital. And then we get two interwoven versions of the same basic story revolving around the same central character, Melinda, played by Radha Mitchell. One story is a heavy drama, the other a romantic comedy. Why is this so perfect for Allen? Because for the last 25 years, he has been zigzagging between comedy and drama, first abandoning slapstick and parody for his imitation Swedish art movie Interiors, and then working his way back to more soulful comedy in The Purple Rose of Cairo and Hannah and Her Sisters. He had some sort of dramatic breakthrough with Husbands and Wives, which was made in the throes of his scandalous breakup with Mia Farrow. But his last four movies have been clunker comedies. They were a desperate attempt to regain the goodwill of an audience that has abandoned him. Allen once said that doing comedy meant sitting at the children's table, and he wanted to eat with the grown-ups, which was a blow to those of us who think that comedy can be a great grown-up art form, too. So Melinda and Melinda is of extraordinary interest to Allen watchers, a friendly contest between his two muses, maybe even a kind of summing up. The grim news is that both muses are shriveled, sclerotic shells of their former selves. His drama half features young Manhattanites in absurdly huge apartments uttering bleak statements about their unfulfilled longings in an indifferent universe with a soundtrack of classical music. His comedy half features young Manhattanites in absurdly huge apartments jabbering sillier statements about their unfulfilled longings in an indifferent universe with a soundtrack of big band jazz. One story ends sadly and makes you feel bad. One ends with an unlikely smooch and makes you feel good. And that's it, folks. It's not news that Allen's ear for drama is three-quarters deaf. His dialogue sounds like Victorian Ibsen translations. But his ear for comedy is mostly gone, too. Here's Will Ferrell as an out-of-work actor married to budding film director Amanda Peet. Ferrell is the latest gifted actor to do a mincing, blurting Woody Allen imitation.
I hope tonight didn't kill my chances of getting my movie made.
No. I think Steve Walsh was okay. I told him I was going to play one of the male characters in the movie.
What did he say?
Nothing. We discussed acting. I told him about my award-winning interpretation of Pygmalion.
Hobie, that was in college.
Still, I thought it was a brilliant idea to play Henry Higgins with a limp.
Ferrell's character is madly in love with Melinda, the adorably unstable downstairs neighbor with a string of failed relationships. He feels guilty, though. He says, I want to touch her, and then I'm at Nuremberg. which gives you an idea of how contemporary Allen's reference points are. The drama's Melinda is a dangerously unstable, even suicidal mother cut off from her children. She moves in with her class-conscious college friend, played by Chloe Sevigny, and her selfish out-of-work actor husband, played by Johnny Lee Miller. This destabilizes what has already been a bad arrangement. The final blow is the arrival of a suave pianist and composer, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, who stirs the souls and the erotic longings of both women to Melinda's anguish.
These things happen. Living is messy.
My head is spinning. I need to lie down and rest. I want to close my eyes and never open them again. I'm going out the window.
Alice!
Malik! What are you doing?
The Australian actress Radha Mitchell is the only reason to see the movie. She has an extraordinary open face and a way of mixing dreaminess with sudden bursts of lacerating emotion that recalls Jessica Lange. And Chloe Sevigny is such a good, unaffected actress that she transcends her lumpy dialogue and her character's shallowness. Melinda and Melinda gives you two lousy movies for the price of one, and the spectacle of Woody Allen's creative bankruptcy doesn't make for a very good time. His ideas about comedy and drama turn out to be banal, and he still can't bring himself to regard comedy as anything but a mirthful diversion on the way to the grave. This is what happens when a once vital artist stews in his own juices for too long. Comedy, drama, it makes no difference. They both come from the same stagnant well.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from HarperCollins, publisher of With No One as Witness by Elizabeth George, featuring Scotland Yard Inspector Thomas Lindley, available wherever books are sold, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology. Emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Judith Warner writes that a choking cocktail of guilt and anxiety and resentment and regret is poisoning motherhood in America. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Judith Warner about her new book, Perfect Madness, Motherhood in the Age of Anxiety. Join us for the next Fresh Air.